Okay. So we're going to continue with our letter Samach. Anybody remember what number letter this is?
60.
Close. Yeah, yes, that's its numerical value is 60. But what number in the alphabet are we?
Oh.
60.
Close.
13, is it? 14.
Yeah. Close again.
15.
Ah, 15. There we go. Yes, we're up to number 15. Why is that significant? You'll have to wait. But it is going to be significant. But let's just review for a moment here. The letter Samach, right? As I showed you always, it's the complete circle. It's a total circle, right? With a little slice at the bottom to tell the difference between that and the Mem. And the word Samach itself meant to support or to rely on, right? And one of the examples we gave was the concept of rabbinic ordination, smicha, right? Of giving it over, right? That this student can now be relied upon. We spent a lot of time talking about the concept that it follows the letter Nun, right? Do you remember that? Nun was the letter that stood, or at least one aspect of it, meant to fall, nefila, but Samach means to support. So even those that fall, God is there to support. And we talked a lot about that whole concept of the Samach supporting the fallen Nun. And we spent time talking about that's really what the word nes, Nun followed by the Samach, spelling the word nes for miracle. And we talked a lot about the idea of miracle of nature, right? And we tied it into Hanukkah. I'm not going to review all of that, but I think you're familiar with this. But as always, we look to the Talmud when it discusses the letters of the alphabet. What is the symbol or what's the message that's being conveyed? And the Talmud here gives us two expressions to teach us about this letter Samach. One is the one common that we were just talking about, called Samoch Aniyim, which means to support the impoverished, to support those who are poor, to be a support for those in need. It's not limited to those who are financially having hardships. It certainly includes that, but it's not limited to that. It's anybody who's impoverished in any particular area. If someone needs help, not financially, but they need a shoulder to cry on, they need advice, they need whatever it is, they are considered poor and impoverished. And if you have the ability to support them, rely, give them a little help, then by all means, that's what we're supposed to do. But there's a second explanation that the Talmud gives for the word Samach, and that is Simanim Asa Batorah. Simanim, anybody know what the word Siman? What is it, David?
A sign or symbol?
A sign or symbol, that's correct. One of the most fascinating aspects, if you're really into the non-traditional, the more out-of-the-box kind of Torah study, there's so many signs, symbols, mnemonics that are utilized in the Torah. For example, right? Most understand it as it's a memory aid. I think one that we're all familiar with is when we sit down at the Seder on Passover night and we talk about the 10 plagues. Immediately following it is a statement. Rabbi Judah says, Simanim, it says, Rabbi Yehuda, Asa Simanim. He made a mnemonic device, Detzach Adash Be'achav, which is really just the first letter of each of those 10 plagues. Detzach is Dalid, which stands for Dam, blood. Right? Detzach Tzadi stands for Tzvardeya, frogs. The Kuf stands for Kinim, lice, and it goes down the list. Without getting into the deeper meaning of it, it's a simple memory device. If you're being asked to remember 10 things, it's not so simple. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda came up with a memory aid for us how to remember it. Even concepts like numerical values of words that we keep referring to, those are also memory and mnemonics, kinds of simanim, kinds of signs and markings. I love this one. How many mitzvot are there in the Torah in totality? Biblical commandments. We all know 613, correct? We all knew that. Wouldn't it be cool if the word Torah had the numerical value of 613? Wouldn't that be awesome? But it doesn't. Some of you from New York or maybe heard of this. There used to be a paper, maybe it's still out. It's called the Jewish Press. The Jewish Press, it's a publication, whatever. It's not the highest caliber of literature and scholarship. Let's put it that way. But it's cute, whatever. It kept Jews involved. They once put out a Purim edition. Now, Purim is always about cute spiels, a spoof, something cute. So they put what was called Not the Jewish Press. It was very cute. And there was a big advertisement in the middle of it. And it said, we'd like to announce the engagement of our daughter, Barbara, to Dr. So-and-so, graduating magna cum laude from Harvard, blah, 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 blah. And at the very bottom it says, but we can't. One of my favorites, right? So wouldn't it be great if the numerical value of Torah was 613, but it's not. It's only 611. Tough is 400, Vav is 6, that's 406, Resh is 200, that's 606, and a Hey is 5, is only 611. Darn, would have been so cool. But if you know a little bit of how the Torah was given to us, you'll appreciate it. Why? Because the Talmud tells us that when God spoke the Ten Commandments, he first spoke the first one. And it was in a revelation that blew the minds of the people. And he said the second one. And again, just mind-blowing, a revelation you and I cannot even begin to understand. And at that point, the Jewish people turned to Moses and said, it's too much. We can't hear it directly from God. Please, let him say it out loud to you and you pass it down to us. So if you want to be technical, of all the commandments in the Torah, two were taught to us directly by God and 611 were taught to us by Moses, right? Well, read the verse, Torah tziva lanu Moshe, one of the most, you know, we learned that as a young child and we sing it, Torah, 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 Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Torah that was commanded to us through Moses is an inheritance for the Jewish people. Well, if you read it carefully, it says Torah 611 were commanded to us through, Moses. That is 100% true. Because two of them we heard directly from God. So even the numerical value of words are also kinds of simanim, signs or indications, memory devices, mnemonics, okay? One more for you. Many of you have been have heard me talk about what's known as the Siyum HaShas, the completion of the entire Talmud, that 7.5 year cycle. Okay. The word Siyum just literally means completion. Lisayim means to finish, to complete. So the noun of the celebration or the completion is called a Siyum. Now, I went to that Siyum twice. Neither occasion was I finishing the Talmud. I had not done the study. Do I have the right to celebrate? You say, okay, whatever, you're part of it, why not? But the great Vilna Gaon, the great genius from Vilna, who lived in the 1800s, late 1700s really, he said unbelievable insight. There's a rule that if I complete a tractate and I invite you to my party, to celebrate its completion, you have the exact same status of celebration as I do. That's a fact. That's a fact. Where's the allusion to it? He says, because the word Siyum is comprised of four letters. They are Samach, Yud, Vav, and Mem. That spells the word Siyum. But what's fascinating is these are the only four letters in the Hebrew alphabet where when you spell it out, meaning, let's take the letter we're talking about, the letter Samach. So if you phonetically had to spell it out, it would be a Samach Mem Chaf, Samach. Yes? You following this? So phonetically. So if you put the letter samach by itself, the other part that's silent or not visible, it's invisible, right? When I draw the letter samach, I say all three letters, but I only see the first one, the samach, right? So the visible part is a samach. The non-visible part is the mem chaf. Similarly, how about the letter mem? Well, that's a mem and another mem. That's how you phonetically spell mem. And yud would be yud vav dalid. Yud and ud, right? Yud. That's how you would phonetically. So you have vav is vav vav. Same thing. These are the four letters where the visible part, its value, is exactly the same as the invisible part. Let's go through it. The samach itself is 60. Mem and chaf, the invisible part, is 40 and 20. It's also 60. The visible and the invisible are exactly the same. Similarly, the letter yud, the first letter yud is 10. But Vav Dalid, the other part, the invisible part, is 6 and 4. That's also 10. And Mem is easy, Mem and Mem. Vav is easy, Vav and Vav. These are the letters, says the Vilna Gaon, that shows you that the visible part is equal to the invisible. That means the one who's actually completed it and the ones who are participating, they're the invisible, they're equal. And they have the right to celebrate as much. It's ingenious. Beautiful. Yeah, that's why they don't call me Tachman Gaon. They don't call me that. They just call me T, right? If I'm lucky, I get a full name. Other, it's just a letter. The Vilna Gaon, he's a genius. Okay. This is what the Talmud is telling us, another aspect in terms of the letter Samach, that it stands for making simanim. Now, I could, but I'm not. I would love to take an opportunity one of these days to come back to this concept because it really ties into one of the strangest customs we have. And that is many of us, probably all of us, have certain things that we do on Rosh Hashanah that we do as a significant omen for a good year. The classic example is you dip your apple in honey. You've all heard of that one, right? But there are literally 5, 10, 15 others that have popped up as a custom over the years. But they all have this concept of we are setting a tone, a sign for the upcoming year. We want it to be a good, sweet new year, so we're going to dip an apple in honey. Now, I play the rabbi most of the days, but every now and then I like to take off my kippah and be the heretic. I would love to do that right now. Because on the surface, that makes no sense. Why? Because I did some crackpot action of taking an apple, dipping it in honey, eating it, and saying, oh, sweet new year. Who the heck are we kidding? Don't we have to do teshuvah? Don't we have to do a little soul searching and repent a little? Don't we have to look inside and ourselves and say, God, you to God, I can't say you to man, you to God, you're it. I mean, I coronate you again. Don't you have to do, you mean just by dipping a fashtunk in an apple in honey and I got, wow, now magically I got a sweet new year? What is up with it? And there's literally, I have a list of at least 13, I think 12 or 13 significant omens that we do. There's eating dates. Why? Because the word for dates has to do with destruction. And we say, oh God, destroy all of our enemies. Okay, what's up with that? And there's a whole lot. So I really want to go through it, but it's going to take us off track. I'll tell you what, hold it off to the side. If we finish everything else I need to cover, we'll come back to it. Okay? But just make a mental note that this is a topic that really needs to be explored. Okay, fine. So we talked about the letter Samach, its name, right, to support or to have a sign, a symbol of some sort. We talked about its shape, the fact that it's a circle completion, right? We talked about how in a marriage, the bride circles the groom, and similarly, the one object that has become the standard for betrothing and marrying is a ring, a symbol of a complete samach, a complete circle. So we talked about it. So let's, and we'll tie it back in a minute. But what we have not talked about is its numerical value of 60. This number 60 is fascinating. It really, really is. I'm going to ask you a following trivia question, and I'm curious, how many of you, what is the highest number, that is ever used as a counting point in Judaism? What's the highest number? I know you can count till infinity, just keep adding it, but an official number that's used.
400?
400. Right. Well, that's a very low number. It's a good number, but it's a very low number. What else? Don't be shy. Come on.
1,000? 6,000?
6,000. Jay wants that. You like that, Sandy. 6,000. Still too low. But you're on the right track.
10,000.
10,000. Oh, now we're moving, right? If only these were real dollar bills, right? Do I hear 10,000? 10,000, 10,000. Who wants to go for 20,000? 20,000, 20,000. Anymore. Okay? Nope, 10,000 still too low.
24,048.
Good try. 24,048. No.
I have some memory from Kabbalah class, but I may have been inebriated that night. So I'll say it anyway, that it had to do with souls, and it was a big number. So I think I'm really out of the ballpark, but I'm going to say like 160.
160? That's your
thousand. Thousand. 160,000.
That's a very big number.
That's a big number.
The number of Israelites, 600 and some thousand, that number.
You in agreement with that, David? Yeah, the correct answer is 600,000. Now, it's true, Monroe, you're right. When the census was taken, it was 613,000 or whatever. But if you're talking about wholesome numbers, the largest number ever, there's no such number as a million. Yes, I know how to say that. I can make up a Hebrew word, and I can certainly string enough letters to get the numerical value of a million. But that number does not exist in Torah. The largest whole, I don't want to use the word whole number, I'm not talking mathematics, but the largest top number, top billing number in the Torah is 600,000. And you're right, Monroe. The example is that's the number that's used to describe the number of Jews that were the root of the Exodus. 600,000 men from the ages of 20 to 60, they left. But Susan, you weren't so wrong. You put a one in the wrong place. You put a one there. But you are correct because you said it had something to do with souls.
Yes.
You are correct. There is a total, the Talmud says, and it's brought down also in Kabbalistic literature, there's a grand total of 600,000 root souls. Now, I'm using the word root souls because obviously there's more than 600,000 people. And by definition, you got to have more than 600,000 souls. So root souls means it's a super soul that has multiple pieces, dimensions, however you want to understand it, that gets divvied up amongst people. It plays right into the concept of when you find your spouse that you found your soul mate. Oh, yeah, there is something to that. Of where there's a sharing of souls. Okay. Why am I making such a big deal of the 600,000? Is because this 600,000 does not, it's not expressed as 600,000s. There are only five, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, you have the ones place, the tens
digits.
Place, the hundreds. What is
digits.
It?
Digits.
Digits, thank you. There are only five places for digits in Judaism. Well, that knocks out 100,000 then. It's ones, tens, hundreds, thousands, and 10,000s. That's where it stops. In all of Judaic literature, when you want to express 600,000, you write 60 10,000s. There is no such thing as 100,000. There's no such thing. Maybe in modern Hebrew, they made what up a term. But in Tanakh, in Torah literature, the highest value is a 10,000. And when you express the highest number in that, it's 60 times that. You understand why I'm even bringing this up now? The number, the letter Samach is 60. So we have to understand this. Okay.
So.
Go ahead.
What is 10,000?
Rebo. Resh bet vav aleph. Rebo. So Shishim Rebo is 60 10,000s, otherwise known as 600,000. Shishim Rebo. Now. Let me tell you a fascinating thing about this number 60, and you'll see where we go with this. There is a law, I think I've shared this. There's a law that says that when you have a something that gets mixed, that's not supposed to be mixed. For example, if I'm cooking my beef stew, my cholent for Shabbos, and I put it up Friday, of course, because I want to make sure that it's all cooked in time for Shabbos. And I'm getting my meat in there, and I got my beans and my potatoes and onion, and start spicing it, and I put the water in, and I'm so excited. And right before I put the lid on, in walks my 2.5-year-old grandson, and he trips holding his sippy cup of milk, and a drop of milk lands right smack in the middle of my cholent, and it gets absorbed right away. What do you do? Yeah, I know. You dial 410-96. Yeah. Rabbi, what's the deal here? So the law is as follows.
Nothing.
Well, it depends, Sharon. let me keep my rabbinic degree. You have to measure. Now, you don't have to sit there with a scooper. You may have to if it gets down to it. But if just based on the way you're looking at it, there is more than 60 times that little drop of milk. There's more meat substance. The cholent is 60 times greater than the volume of that one drop of milk. Then halachically, it's okay. You do not have to throw out your cholent. You have to say hallel that you have cholent, but you do not have to throw out the cholent. Why? Because if it's a more than a 1 to 60 ratio, it becomes insignificant and nullified. It's a very fascinating law. It's not limited to milk and meat. It's a general rule of a 60 to 1 ratio. You see it not only in the physical realm, you even can associate it with non-physical things. For example, the Talmud says, you know, Rhett, you like to sleep? Rhett, you like sleeping?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know why? Because the what happens when we sleep is that we get a little bit of a taste of what the tranquility is after we pass from this world. The Talmud uses the expression, sleep is 1/60th of death. A dream is 1/60th of prophecy. Honey, the taste, the sweetness of honey is 1/60th of the sweetness that was for the manna that was provided for the Jews in the desert. Enjoying Shabbos is 1/60th of the world to come. And there are other such examples. But I want you to take a moment and ask yourself, okay, if you just want to impress upon me that it's a fraction of, why'd you choose a 1 to 60 ratio? Why not 1/100th? Why not 1/10th? The answer is because if you have 1 to 60, that means it still has a little, the tiniest left of significance. More than a 1 to 60 ratio, meaning it's 1 to 100, it's insignificant. You can't taste it. You can't feel it. It's gone. 1 to 60 is the ratio at the upper limit of where it still retains its identity. You follow that? 60, therefore, is the number that represents the maximum part of where something loses and becomes nullified. It no longer has an existence or an identity of its own once you cross that 60 threshold. Does that make sense? This is genius. Let's take an example, okay? The Jewish people, they come to Mount Sinai and they're about to be given the Torah. And strangely enough, the Torah uses a term that says, when it should say that they encamped around the mountain, it says, and he, in the singular, he encamped around the mountain, meaning Mount Sinai. And Rashi and the other commentators, all quoting early sources, say that's an unusual grammatical, seems to be a mistake. It should be in the plural because there's, again, hundreds of thousands, millions of people there. Why use the singular? Says Rashi, because the Jews stood there ki'ish echad belev echad, like one man with one heart. The unifying aspect that we experienced standing around the mountain was almost unheard of and hard to replicate throughout our history. But at that moment, we were. But what's the number that's used? We were 600,000. Let's put it in the terms that we've established. 60 ten thousands. What does that mean? That means we just at that point, the number of Jews standing around the Torah, standing around the mountain to receive the Torah, we just crossed the threshold of where we saw ourselves as individuals, and we now became quote unquote nullified unto the greater, bigger picture known as the Jewish people. We crossed the line positively and viewed ourselves as one giant entity. No longer were we 599,999 individuals. We crossed the line. We now became 60, complete, moving into the realm of part of the Jewish people. The true organic connection between all the root souls that had been there, that were there. We now all became one organic whole. Yes? Hence the terminology, the 600,000 is not just six times 100,000. It's 60 of the 10,000s. Now, if this isn't blowing your mind enough, let's go a little further. How many souls do you have inside of you? How many souls, Susan? What would you say? How many souls?
It depends what day it is. Some days I have more, some days I have
less. Also depends if you're inebriated. I get it. Fine. No problem.
It's either one or 60.
The correct answer is one. You have one soul. But what most people don't know is that it's not one dimensional. There are five parts to your soul. Five parts. The most basic primal part of your soul is that which gives your life essence to you. You're breathing, you're alive, right? Your soul provides that to you. Your heart is pumping, thank God your kidneys are functioning, everything's work, but with all your organs can be working, but if your soul's gone, you're dead. Your soul on its most basic level provides your life essence. In Hebrew, it's called nefesh. Nefesh, that's your life essence. Okay, then there's a higher level, and that's called ruach, spirit. Now, we're not talking about what we share in common with an animal. They also have a life essence. They're alive. But now we're a little bit higher. We're called ruach. That aspect of the soul is called spirit. Then there's a higher aspect called neshama, the soul. These are all, again, maybe when we do a Kabbalistic talk, we'll talk about all five and what the deeper meanings are. But let's work with this for now. So the lowest level is nefesh, then comes ruach, then neshama. Then you get to the next higher level is called chaya. You know, like a girl's name, Chaya. That's what it is. And then the highest level is called Yechida. The word Yachid means an individual, singular. The opposite of praying with a minion, with a quorum, is where you're davening biyichidut, alone, by yourself, one. Fascinating. The highest level of your soul is connecting the idea of oneness. Oneness with what? Two possibilities. One, God. That's the highest level of connection. But it also means that you and I can connect on that level and we become one. And when you multiply it out, not just me and you, but to the whole nation, yeah, we become one people. We become one nation. That's the point of connection. It's not surprising, therefore, I told you that we only use five digits, five places in the mathematics, the ones, the tens, the hundreds, the thousands, and the 10,000s. The 10,000s is the yechida. That's matching at that highest level. Bingo. So when you have 60 of those, that implies the greatest level of transferring from individuality to now becoming part of a bigger whole. That's what this number says. 600,000 is 60 times the highest number, the highest digit of 10,000, which is yechida, that point of connection and oneness. So 60, again, going to your form of a complete circle, total completion of nullifying the individual aspect subsumed under the larger global picture. That's really what 60 represents. It's not surprising, therefore, that there are six orders of Mishnah, right? Those are the six categories that the entire oral Torah is divided into. Yet there's subcategories when you break them down into tractates. There are 60 of them because that's the completion, the totality of it. So the number of root souls, the completion and the totality of the Jewish people being expressed as 60 times the 10,000 brings us to one more point with the 60. The source of blessing we know is God. Everything is from God. All source of blessing comes from God. In fact, and I've said this many, many times, when you start your prayers and you say, Baruch Atah Hashem, it does not mean I am blessing you, God. That makes no sense. I'm in no position to bless God. I have nothing that he doesn't. In fact, he has everything and I got garnished. I got nothing. I got nada. Unless he bestows it upon me. Therefore, the correct translation of Baruch Atah Hashem is a statement of fact. Blessed are you, God, because you are the source of all blessing. It's a statement, not a prayer. It's not a, I'm wishing my best to you, God. Here, I'm paying it forward. No, it doesn't work that way. You are the source of blessing. Now, that being the case, it calls into question one of the strangest customs we have. And I say that every week because we got a lot of strange ones. Every holiday, we have something called Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessings. Right? You guys are familiar with this, of where those who come from Aaron, right, a descendant from Aaron, from the tribe of Levi, they have the privilege of being, you know, the higher echelons of Jewish society and hierarchy. Jay, you're a Kohen? You want to be one? For this class, you know, listen, for 10,000, maybe 600,000, we can make it happen.
I was going to say, for a donation, I'm sure there would be.
Come on. It's COVID. It's okay. Fine. No. So you have those who come from that line. So they get up on the platform in front of the ark and they quote unquote bless the people. They put their hands out, right? And they're covering with their talit and nobody's supposed to look. And it's a lot of hibby-jibby stuff. But I don't understand. They're blessing the people? Haven't you heard from me enough times to know there is no such concept that a person is bestowing blessing on anybody? You can wish that God bestow a blessing on you. And that's what it is when I wish you well. I'm in no position to offer anything. I pray and I wish that God bless you with X, Y, and Z. So what in tarnation are the Kohanim doing? They're not blessing. Rather, they are the conduit. They are the means by which God's blessing comes to the Jewish people. And I have no qualms, and I've brought this up with many of my friends who are Kohanim, and I try to bring them back down to earth and remind them that they're just a conduit. Come back off your mighty horse. Come on down. You're good, but you're not that good. Don't get excited. Don't take it out on the rest of us plebes. But a Kohen is a conduit. That's all he is. But here's what's fascinating. They make three blessings. They utter three sentences. Yivarechecha Hashem v'yishmerecha. God should bless you and protect you. Right? And there's a song that goes with it, I know. Right? And then you have the next line. May God shine his countenance upon you and find favor. I don't remember all the English. Whatever. You have three sentences of blessing.
Be gracious unto you.
Be gracious unto you. Perfect. Okay? And then you have the third one of, again, God should lift up his countenance towards you and give you peace or something like that. Okay. Yeah. It flows much easier in Hebrew, folks. It really does. Yisa Hashem panav eilecha v'yaseim lecha shalom. Okay, perfect. Okay. If you look at the structure of those blessings, you will find fascinating. The first sentence has three words. The second sentence has five words. And the third sentence has seven words. For a grand total of 15. Ooh, 15. I told you we'd get back to this at some point. 15 is a 1 and a 5, right? Which is 6. 6, as we said way back when, 6 is the number of the completion of the physical world. God created the universe in 6 days. He rested on the 7th. The concept of completion in the physical realm is 6. Wait, hold on. If you look at those same three sentences, where the first sentence was three words, it's comprised of 15 letters, those three words. The second sentence, which was five words, are comprised of 20 letters. And the third sentence, which was seven words, are comprised of 25 letters. 15 plus 20 is 35. 35 and 25 is... ding, 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 60. So now you have the words are 6, the letters are 60, and wait, it gets better. The Talmud says that there are 30 bones in your hand. How they classify that, I don't know, but 30 bones in the hand. Now, we all know the classic picture of the Kohen extending his hand. No. Hands, both hands are extended to be the conduit by which the blessing comes through. Is how many total bones? Yeah, you got it. 60 bones. This number 60 is the concept of transforming ourselves as an individual to reaching the next point of completion. Again, going back to what we said last week about the union between a husband and a wife. It's the same concept. If you want your marriage to be strong, then you have to learn to nullify yourself somewhat, making space for your spouse that you can share in the same space, but you then form and complete the union. That's a marriage. Hence the circle, hence the ring, hence this number 60 representing reaching that level of nullifying me as a personal individual and subsuming myself into the greater, the larger picture known as Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people. Hence, anytime you come across this number 60, it means completion and totality. This makes sense, yes? There's so much more I want to say here. I'll touch on it. The two happiest days on the Jewish calendar. What are the two happiest days on the Jewish calendar? What holidays? Go ahead. Share it with me. What would you say? Sharon, give me one of the happiest days on the Jewish calendar.
Purim.
Purim. Great choice, but wrong.
I didn't say it was right. He said, just give you one.
Good choice. What other? Give me another one.
Simchat Torah.
Simchat Torah. Great choice, but still wrong.
Hanukkah.
Hanukkah. Well, that's not in the Torah. So I can't.
No, that's true.
Totally wrong on that one. No.
Sukkah.
Which one?
Sukkah.
Sukkos. Nope. Not that one either.
Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur. Who said Yom Kippur? Jay? Really? That's a happy day? I don't know what shul you go to. But you're right.
But you're right.
That is one, and we'll see why in a moment. But that was the easy one. Now comes the hard one. What's the second holiday that is identified in the Mishnah as one of the two happiest days on the calendar?
Pesach.
Good guess, but wrong.
I'm too fishy.
We're running out of holidays.
Tisha B'Av?
Tisha B'Av? Okay, I want to go to your shul. Tisha B'Av in my shul is quite sad. It will one day be, Elian. One day it will be one of the happiest. But for right now.
Okay, for right now.
Right now. David, you look so perplexed.
Tu B'Shvat. No
idea, huh?
I said Shabbos, but it's not one. It's a many.
True. But it's no. Shavuot? Most of you have never even heard of this holiday. What, Susan?
Well, you've heard of Shavuot, so I know that's not.
Nope, it's not Shavuot.
Tu B'Av.
It's called Tu B'Av.
Oh,
Tu B'Av. Yeah. Like, what? I heard a Tisha B'Av, and I heard a Tu B'Shvat, but what's Tu B'Av? You know, not Tuba, Tu B'Av.
I know what it is in modern times. It's like considered almost the equivalent of Valentine's Day, because that's when my brother and his wife got married.
Great. It's a shame that is what it's become in people's minds, is the Jewish Valentine's Day. It is, I understand where it's coming from, but it is way more than that. Way more.
Never heard of it.
Let's just translate the words. Two is just a short way of saying number 15, because you spell it with a tet and a vav. So you phonetically pronounce it as two, like Tu B'Shvat, right? Tu B'Shvat is the 15th day of the Hebrew month of Shvat. So this is Tu B'Av, the 15th in the month of Av. That's the calendar date for this.
6 days.
Now, the Mishnah identifies numerous happy aspects of it, but one that Elion is referring to that made it super, super happy is that on this day, they went out, the girls would go out in the field and try to find themselves a husband. It was, you know, it was long before speed dating, long before, what do they call it? Tinder and swipe right and swipe left. And I don't even know what this stuff is, right? But this was the Jewish way of going to meet. Instead of at a bar, you met out in the field and you danced. Okay. Why would that be considered one of the happiest days? Well, before you answer that, let's go back to Jay's answer. Jay said that Yom Kippur, and he's right. I'm not trying to belittle it, and I get how critically important Yom Kippur is on the calendar. But to use the term happiness, I'm not so sure. I can say relieved. I can say, thank God this period is over. Let's party. Let's go back to life, right? But happy? No. But as adults, we've come to appreciate, I hope, that what Yom Kippur is and why it's such a happy day is because it gives us a fresh start. We're able to correct mistakes, and that's really what we try to do in life. Yom Kippur is a day of atonement. Thank God we're given an opportunity to clear the slate again. I can't think of a happier occasion. to know that after we've hurt somebody's feelings and they say, I forgive you, it's such a relief. You're able to move on because you've been racked with anxiety. You're racked with guilt. You're racked with all these other stuff. And God says, I love you. I forgive you. Let's move on from here. It is the happiest day on the calendar. Because what you've in effect done is because God granting us forgiveness, we've been able to reconnect. That's been the theme I've been trying to impress upon you about what Samach is all about. Supporting someone else, connecting with someone else, encircling someone or others into your circle. Yom Kippur is that reconnection once again. It makes a lot of sense then that Tu B'Av is also that time of where the women, the men, they're trying to find their soulmates. They're trying to connect with each other, committing to each other to support each other. Remember we talked about nullifying to make room for someone else? Yeah. Isn't that what a marriage is supposed to be? Yeah. But why is Tu B'Av so important to us? Two reasons. Because if you really want to know, in Hasidic literature, they make a play on words with that term. Tu B'Av, as I told you, means two is Tet Vav 15, B'Av in the month of Av. That's the Hebrew name. However, in Hasidic literature, they do it differently. They say it's two, it's 15, B'Aleph Beis. It's the 15th letter in the Aleph Bet, because that's how you spell Av, Aleph Bet. Look to the 15th letter of the alphabet and you'll get the clue why this is such an important holiday. What's the 15th letter? Yeah, that's our word. That's our letter, Samach. Yeah, it's a hidden allusion to the fact that the 15th letter, which is all about Samach, that's the key to the holiday of Tu B'Av. But wait, it gets one last hurrah. Because when you spell out Samach, you know what it stands for? Jay, you're going to love this. The hair is going to stand up. I'm telling you. Samach stands for Slicha, Mechila, Kapara, which are the three terms for forgiveness in the Torah. Yeah, because that's what a Samach is all about. Seeing yourself, nullifying, asking forgiveness, getting forgiveness, reconnecting on the highest levels. Yeah. That's what all of this 60 is about. That's what the blessings of the Kohanim are all about. Reconnecting with God. So yeah, Samach in the most basic form means support, to rely on. But my goodness, how much deeper it really goes when you examine it and see that the entire energy of this letter Samach is that point of where I take the step back as an individual and connect to someone or something else on a much higher level to a point of where we become the completed unit. My relationship with God and my relationship with others. That's a Samach. And that's really the complete circle. Whatever. I have about five more pages, but whatever. We'll save it for another time. I'll open up to questions if anyone has. Come on, Jay, I see the hair standing. Isn't that fascinating? Unbelievable. Loved it. When I saw that, I was like, oh, oh. Now I'm ready to teach. Yes, Robin.
So I think what you were saying, we're going back to Yom Kippur again, you know, as far as getting a fresh start. But then part of that is the not just the connection, but the completion. Like you're completing your year, you're completing what you've done wrong, and you're completing it and starting.
Complete, not so much your year, but you're completing the cycle of reconnecting back with God. Rosh Hashanah, remember, Rosh Hashanah is my declaration that God is king. Now I've realized, uh-oh, you know who I've messed up? You know who I sinned against? This ain't just Joe Schmo. This is God, king of the universe. Oive. I better get my affairs in order. I better ask forgiveness. And when we're granted that forgiveness, we complete the cycle in the relationship with God. That's, by the way, why Yom Kippur follows Rosh Hashanah and not what logically should have been the other way. First ask forgiveness for last year and then start a new year. But there's a method to the madness here. You can't really ask forgiveness until you've recognized whom you've sinned against, whom you've harmed, what relationship you've harmed. Then you can go and correct it. Otherwise, it's just blah, blah, blah. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
So that has the completion part with the cycle also. Connecting. Completion and connecting.
Correct. Susan, yeah.
This is a little bit of a Hillel question asking you on one leg too. If you can give a word for the aspect of the soul that is Chaya, what would that be?
I'm not sure. I don't want to say something that's incorrect. I would want to look back at my notes.
Okay. I'll get back to you.
Yeah. I want to rethink that. Before I answer it, I have my knee jerk was something, but then I'm questioning myself. So I don't want to give you misinformation. Anything else?
Weren't you going to come back to something? I can't remember what it was.
Well, that was the 15. The fact that it was the 15th letter. 156, right? Hud hud hike.
Right. You had more examples. You had more.
Examples. Oh, all the signs. Ah, there you go, Robin. Thank you, Susan.
I know it was something I knew, but I couldn't remember either. So
that's what
Susan.
It was. So here's another whole page called, what does it say? It says, Rosh Hashanah, Model Seder for Jewish Deaf. I gave a great class years ago trying to teach the Jewish community, the deaf community in Columbus, Ohio, all about these significant signs and omens. And I mean, just communicating with them was fascinating, but to see the light bulbs go off in their heads, because, you know, I say it and some of them are able to lip read and others were listening to the interpreter. And I'm watching as she's interpreting and you see them going, you know, like you see the eyebrows go up, like, what? Never heard of that before. It's fascinating. It's like almost like a time delay. It's very cool. So, it's late.
One sign.
Give you one? Okay.
Yeah, one.
Right. Okay. Forget what the actual... It is, you know, there's dates and there's leeks and there's what else do we have? We have pomegranates. There's a lot of them. And most of them are based on either their name or what they represent. Like pomegranates, they say that our merits, all of our good deeds, our merits should be as many and multiples as like the seeds of a pomegranate, which is a lot of seeds. You know, if it says it should be like the seeds of a peach tree, that means we got one. We're good. That's it. You know, we want merits that are increased or fish. Right? Some people have fish because we should, again, our merits should increase like fish in the sea. It's just multiple. But whatever it is, my question that I was dealing with is how does my doing this, what seems to be just a superstitious action now is going to bring about a good year? It seems very un-Jewish, to be honest. So there's, again, I'm oversimplifying it, but I'll share one thought with you. Do you ever hear the term, you are what you eat? Right? You've heard that expression. Do you believe it?
Mm-hmm.
You do believe it. Really?
Yeah.
Really? I can start calling you potato head? like, what do you mean you are what you eat? What does that mean? If I eat hot dogs, I'm going to be a hot dog? I mean, what does it mean? It's such a crazy expression. Oh, I know you're going to tell me it means that if you put junk in your body, then your body's going to break down and you're going to be junk. And I get it. But it's such a weird expression. But it's true. It is very, very true. You literally become what you eat. You say, what does that mean?
There's an energy that food has that becomes, you become part of that energy. That energy.
Fabulous.
That food has
fabulous.
An energy.
Yes.
Correct, Monroe. Correct.
That's right. Every kosher food, obviously a non-kosher food, you're ingesting negative particles, if I can use the term, right? Kosher food is positive spiritual energy. Every single food has some kind of spiritual energy. You know, it's the reality that you can't see. It's a terrible example, and it's not a kosher food, but it works. I love the commercial for Ragu. Ragu spaghetti sauce, which again, it's not kosher, don't eat it. But in their motto was, it's in there. And they kept talking about how it's just like mama would make, and it's just whatever she, it's in there, it's in there. Go for it, right? It's in there. Every food has an energy. There's a reality in there. Can you see calories in your food? No, you can't see calories. You can see it after you eat it, but you can't see it in the food. But it's there. There are spiritual ingredients in all foods. And when you eat the food, it actually creates something within you. It unleashes its spiritual energy. So therefore, on Rosh Hashanah, we're not just playing some superstitious game. I am making a declaration to God and saying, I really, in my heart of hearts, I want to be blessed with a sweet new year. So God's going to say, so what are you doing about it? You want to just turn to me and say, gimme, gimme, gimme? What are you doing? So you know what I say? I say, I'm going to do actions that are going to impress it upon me externally. I see what I'm doing and I'm going to ingest it. I'm going to ingest those lessons of what each one of these foods represents because I do want that good year. The food's name or the food's character represents a certain trait or a quality, that invisible ingredient. And when you eat and ingest the food, it yields some kind of attachment to a particular trait. So you're doing something actual, positive benefit by eating that food. You had no idea that dipping an apple in honey can be such a spiritual high, but it is. And maybe we'll make a note of it. And Robin, you'll have to remind me because my memory doesn't even last 45 minutes. Right? You'll have to remind me when we get closer to Rosh Hashanah, maybe this year, we'll talk about these things because they do have this representation. But that's really what I was referring to. They're not arbitrary, just make believe some whacked out thing. These foods and these actions are creating a reality within you when you eat it. You are what you eat. And on Rosh Hashanah, when everything is magnified in such a great way, yeah, it takes on tremendous significance. That's the long and short of it.
Which explains when the crazy working mom manages to get the dinner on the table, but never bought apples and is going next door to try and get an apple, which they don't have. And she bursts out crying. That's when she feels like a horrible human being. Yes, that did happen to me when my kids were little.
I believe it. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of deep symbolism in that as well. All right. Anyway, my pleasure. It's great to see you all.
See you tomorrow.
Any other questions? I'm happy to stay on, but if not, we're good.
See you tomorrow.
All right.
See you tomorrow.
Tomorrow night, hopefully at 8 o'clock.
Thank you.
Have a good night, everyone.
Yeah.